Matt and I have a long-running Oscar feud. It started when we shared an apartment with G in Brooklyn, and he pressured me into wagering on the Academy Awards. I had sworn off betting on events ever since I lost a quarter and nearly cried, betting with my mom's boyfriend on the Vikings to beat the Steelers in the Super Bowl in 1975. But Matt was relentless, calling into question my manhood and so on, so to shut him up, I agreed to bet, and promptly got my ass kicked. After we both moved out to LA, the Oscars became a highly anticipated yearly event. I quickly realized that the point was not to vote for the best picture, best actor, and so on, but to vote for who was actually going to win. And once I made that psychological adjustment, my average went way up. It may seem a subtle difference, but it's a crucial one. Betting on the best is an entirely subjective experience. No answer is inherently right, and no amount of arguing will change somebody's mind. But betting on who will win opens up the debate to all sorts of factors that have almost nothing to do with who is better. There's all kinds of politics and truisms that get thrown into the equation, such as best supporting actor is a well-respected old guy who's being honored for a career instead of a role, Jack Palance. Best Supporting Actress is a cookie, someone young and cute, regardless of the role or the film, Marissa Tomei, and the arguments that rage really can and do change people's minds. And that's really most of the fun. The broadcast itself is always a good time, in a really boring sort of way, but it's the month between when the nominees are announced and when the awards are given that's the real entertainment. Matt and I always make a preliminary bet the day the nominations are announced, and then dig into our research in psychology and gamesmanship for a month, trying to get an edge, and trying to psych out our opponent. Although we do believe in full disclosure, all information is freely shared. Ever since Matt discovered during the broadcast, when the ballots are locked, that Stephen Sondheim had written the nominated song from Dick Tracy, and just about had to jump out the window in frustration. Anyway, once I got the hang of it, I started on a tear, beating Matt 5 years in a row. As we always point out, since we're inevitably both in a pool with other people too, winning isn't as important as beating the other guy. If G or Leslie wins the ultimate pot, unlikely, but theoretically possible, I suppose, then that's fine, as long as I beat Matt. And Matt, bless his heart, feels the same way about me. He doesn't care where he ends up in the standings, as long as it's ahead of me. So anyway, I was on a tear, the Lance Armstrong of Oscar betting, until the 1977 Oscars, held in the spring of 1998. That was the only time in the past 10 years or so that Matt and I didn't watch the broadcast together, and the reason was that my son Owen had just been born, and we were still in the hospital recovering. Matt beat me badly that year, and generously offered the fact that I was a bit distracted as consolation. But he beat me fair and square, and I was proud to give him my money. It was strange watching the Oscars in a hospital bed with my wife and newly egressed son. Fresh from the traumatic and bewildering experience of birth, we huddled in the room, trying to adjust to the two that had become three. But as strange as that was, it was nothing compared to what happened during the Oscar broadcast. One of the inevitable lowlights of the show is the singing of the nominated songs. Always boring and bland, always belted out through the roof by some vanilla songbird like Celine Dion. And sure enough, there was Celine, flame-throwing the egregious My Heart Will Go On from Titanic, the eventual winner, to nobody's surprise. But, wait, who's that stumbling onto the stage? Is that Elliot Smith? Alone with an acoustic guitar? Are you kidding me? Life, which I didn't think could get any stranger, had just taken a sharp turn into surreality. You walk down Alameda, shuffling your deck of trick cards over everyone, like some precious only son. Elliot Smith is a singer-songwriter from Portland, the one in Oregon, who was one of the key players of the lo-fi movement. Much like Phil Spector championing mono well into the stereo age, lo-fi aficionados shun the shiny production techniques popular today for a rougher, less polished sound. Some of it is, no doubt, financially motivated. Sounding bad is cheaper than sounding good. But there are some real aesthetic concerns. Lo-fi sounds more human, more homey. Often recorded on a four-track in somebody's bedroom, lo-fi hasn't been compromised by anybody. No label to pressure you, no producer to muck things up, just you and your music, the purity of your vision, and so on. Of course, that's largely a stance, and lo-fi can be compromised just as easily as hi-fi, but the aesthetic reeks of folk art, and that smell is where it gets a lot of its credibility. I guess there's some debate about whether or not Elliot Smith is truly lo-fi, but he's low enough for me. His albums, at least the early ones, are quiet affairs, full of strummed acoustic guitar, drums with no meat on the beat, and mournful lyrics intimately sung.
I had tender feelings that you made hard, but it's your heart, not mine, that's scarred. So when I go home, I'll be happy to go. You're just somebody that I used to know. You don't need my help anymore.
He's got a very lo-fi look, too. Unkempt hair, t-shirts and worn jeans. His demeanor matches his sound. Pleasant enough, but with no real concessions made to polishing or commerciality.
You're just somebody that I used to know. Watched you deal in a dying day, and throw a living that passed away. So you can be sure that you're in control. You're just somebody that I used to know.
Smith is about as far from appealing to a mass audience as you can be. And yet, there he was, slightly rumpled, strumming his guitar and singing about Miss Misery live to over a billion people on the Academy Awards.
I know you don't think you did me wrong, and I can't stay this math alone. Keep in a hold of what you just let go. You're just somebody that I used to know.
I guess they were trying something new that year, and I guess they stopped after that because I haven't seen anybody like that on the show since. And it's too bad they didn't try to get a little edgier the previous year, because then they could have had Fountains of Wayne singing That Thing You Do. But still, it was wonderful to see somebody so completely out of the mainstream inserted into such a festival of commercialism and middle-of-the-road aesthetics.
Start, stop, and start. Stupid acting smart. Flirting with the flicks. You say it's just for kids.
That wonderfully incongruous moment was my favorite of the night. Certainly beats the abusive James Cameron squealing that he was on top of the world. And I drifted off to sleep next to my newly expanded family, thinking about all the ways the world had changed and wondering what else was in store. If I could curl up around my own frighteningly beautiful son, my son, and Elliot Smith can sing at the Academy Awards, well, then, is anything really impossible? Five years later, Smith would be found dead in his L.A. apartment of an apparent suicide. I say apparent because his demeanor and the stinging darkness of his songs made it very easy for everybody to assume that he had killed himself. Just listen to him sing. And although there are no suspects, the method of death, stabbed in the heart, is quite unusual for a suicide, especially since there were apparently no test wounds. Usually, if somebody's going to stab themselves, they do a couple of test jabs to see how it feels and how much pressure to apply and so on. There were apparently no test wounds on his chest, although there were tracks on his arm, Smith having fought with and apparently lost to a heroin addiction. I don't know if the case is still open, but the general consensus seems to be that he killed himself because his songs are so depressing. It's like Sid and Nancy. There's strong evidence and witnesses to suggest that Sid didn't kill Nancy at all, that there was somebody else in the hotel room that night. But nobody wanted to hear that. Sid Vicious, mind you, must have killed Nancy because he was a punk, and that would just make great romantic sense. Never mind the bollocks, never mind the truth, Sid killed Nancy because the media and the police and the culture wanted him to. Case closed. Like Sid, Elliot was the songs he sang and deserved his fate in the court of public opinion. And in a democracy, that's all that counts. Elliot fought against the cult of personality, arguing that the work and the creator should be judged on their own merits and that celebrities shouldn't be treated differently because of what they do. But all that arguing was for naught. In the end, he was what he wrote. He lived by the guitar and died by the knife, and all his protestations added up to a big nothing.